There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I am Al Hunt. This week, our guests are Parisian art expert Yves Estelle and Washington Post columnist and author of a biography of Ronald Reagan, his life and legend, great columnist Max Boot. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write to politicswarroom@gmail.com for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can also get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at politicon.com. Tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please check out the links to our recent sponsors and our past episode show notes, as we thank you for supporting them as it helps make this podcast happen. James, in November, for elections next week, could carry a lot of political weight. I'm assuming the Democrats are going to win the New York governor's race. Mondami is going to be elected mayor of New York. And California redistricting, the Democrats' gerrymandering plan will pass. Thus, I think the critical decider for setting the narrative will be the New Jersey governor's race. If Mikey Sherrill wins, it'll be a pretty darn good Democratic night. If Republicans win, it'll be played as a mixed verdict, especially as I think the Virginia candidate for attorney general has self-destructed. Also important are some other races, though. Let me give you one. That's the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court contest. Actually, it's whether to retain three Democratic members of that court and keep the Democratic majority. State Supreme Courts are underrated. They are terribly important. This has been a good court, a fair court, and I think Democrats are better organized, unlike was the case 3 years ago in North Carolina. They're better organized, they're ready, and I think all three Democrats will be retained.
Oh, okay, so yeah, I agree with you. One other place, something I want to put on the radar screen, is the Georgia Public Service Commission. The two elections up, Democrats have not won a statewide constitutional office in Georgia in 19 years. I am told to, by the state party chair, my dear friend, Charlie Bailey, that the early vote is promising. I don't know what that means. I don't think they have any polling. I don't think we know a lot, but that would certainly be because, you know, Georgia's probably become one of the really key states in presidential politics, and that would be a key indicator.
Would be.
In terms of, I did a lot of calling around this morning and thinking on this, and if Sherrill wins, great. And let's remember that New Jersey didn't go for Harris by a whole lot in Murphy's reelection. I think both of them were under three. And also bear in mind that New Jersey has not elected a political party to a third-term governor in 100 years. And this is not Connecticut. Oh, this is not Massachusetts. Yes, it voted Democratic probably in every election, I presume, since 88. I don't know that, but I'm just thinking back.
Since 92.
We lost in 88.
Right.
I know, because I was running Loudonburg's campaign yet. So I guess it's more accurately since 92. So what number, in this is all against the backdrop of a government shutdown, and And what number would Shell have to win by in New Jersey or Spanberger in Virginia that would get the attention of Republicans in Congress? And if Shell wins by a point and a half, Spanberger wins by three, that's not going to get their attention. And the consensus number that I come up with after numerous phone calls this morning is 5 in New Jersey, 10 in Virginia. Now, it's not to say I'm predicting 5 or anything else, but if anything 5 or better in New Jersey would get, that would get people's attention. And anything 10 or better in Virginia would get people's attention. I know a win is a win because it's a win, but you're hoping that this has some kind of a shakeup effect on national politics and, yeah, and Republican loyalty to Trump.
No, I agree. And a share of loss would be devastating because it would totally wipe out anything for sending a message. I think she'll win. I don't know if she'll win by 5, but I think she'll win. I think Spanberger's going to win. I don't think Spanberger will be able to carry Jones in with her. I just think he's done too much damage to himself. But I want to talk just a minute about state Supreme Court races. The Democrats made a colossal mistake 3 years ago in North Carolina. Republicans poured lots more money into the state. And I knew a little bit about it, more than a little bit, because I know a lot about North Carolina, having lived down there for a while. My kid was involved in a Senate race. And what the Republicans realized was, yeah, we want to pour money into that Senate race, but we really want to control that state Supreme Court, which the Democrats have had controlled, and they had prevented the Republicans from doing the kind of gerrymandering they're doing now. Republicans were on the alert for that. They were active. Democrats were asleep at the switch. Republicans took over that Supreme Court. What that means is that Republican legislature can do whatever they want almost on congressional seats. Right now, it's 10-4. Republican majority should be 7-7, certainly no more than 8-6. They're going to add at least one more to make it 11-3. And really, it all goes back to that Supreme Court race in 2022. If Democrats had held on to that seats, they couldn't get away with this. And that's why the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court election really is important, well beyond what the court decides in other matters.
Well, when you got Josh Shapiro, he doesn't leave things to chance. And him and his trusted sidekick, Sal Shore, his chief consultant, they're not people that believe in just doing nothing. I'll let things go. So I'm very confident that they on top of this, they're on top of the turnout operation, they're on top of the messaging, they're on top of everything. I just don't have any doubt about that. I mean, if we talk about the redistricting, but people need to know, when, at least from what I hear, and you probably follow this closer than I do, that in California, the proposition to allow them to do that is probably going to pass. I mean, but we want to look at it because it's important.
Oh, it's going to cast. I think it'll cast by as much as 15, 20 points.
Okay. And then now in Virginia, again, if you get a big result, they're going to call a special session, and they believe that they can create 3 more Democratic districts. I mean, I'm not sure that when they do the Texas stuff, there's a lot of smart people, I think, just could backfire Republicans. Indiana refused to go along with it, hugely Republican state. Kansas refused to go along with it. I'll tell you how red Kansas is. There's been a lot of hand-wringing on the Democratic side about them, and it's justifiable. They've done some horrible things in redistricting, but this thing might blow up on them. And,
yeah,
you know, in politics, the first rule of politics is the other side gets to play. So you start something, okay, well, they're going to start something too. And, yeah, I don't know what the situation is in some of these other, you know, bluer states, but the Democratic resistance to not doing this or saying, well, this is tradition, we do it every 10 years, we've done it that way, it's a census, the Constitution says. And Democrats are like, well, goddamn, if they're doing that, then we don't have any other choice.
Right.
I'm not telling our mute listeners anything, but I'm not sure it's going to work out all that great for them. And if the Democrats have a big year, it'll work out really poorly for them.
Well, my guess is when it all shakes out, it'll look like Republicans have a 5 or 6 seat advantage. I think that's exaggerated. I think they'll be lucky to have just a couple seat advantage from redistricting. It's all awful. It's terrible. I believe, I think these nonpartisan, bipartisan redistricting commissions actually work. You know, it's a case of basically, I think the voters ought to choose their political representatives, not the other way around. But again, as you said, once, not only did Texas start, Trump is ordering every state to do it. So I think for Democrats to unilaterally disarm really would be irresponsible.
Well, I don't think Democratic voters want to do that. I don't think that, I think if they didn't, one thing that, Democratic politicians are, I see this annoying commentary about Schumer and Jeffers, and people got a problem with us when I'm not here for that. But if they caved, or whatever you call it, they would pay a horrible price for Democratic voters, for Democratic donors. I mean, I've been up here in New York for the past couple of days seeing nothing but Democratic donors. And if I tell you that there's, and I see Democrats on the street, and I know them, I talk to them, there is no appetite for the Democrats to give in on this. And if they did, it would be a horrific backlash in the party. Now, a lot again, and if we do 5 in New Jersey and 10 in Virginia, they ain't no one's going to give in. I mean, that'll just encourage people more. So I don't think anything could happen between 9 and Tuesday. And then after Tuesday, we see. But I can't tell you, our listeners, our viewers, how many calls I'm getting from these Midwestern states. Trump is, I do think it's got to be some kind of mental deterioration or slippage, because what he's doing in Argentina, if you go to AI and say, in the history of Argentina, how many 30-year bonds have they ever paid back? And yeah. I'm told the answer is zero.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what you do is these guys, I did it when I was working down there 10, 15 years ago. These guys, they buy up these bonds at, you know, I don't know, 15 cents on a dollar. Then they go and they pressure and they put pressure on and they say, oh, country's going to fall apart. You got to do this. You got to buy the bonds at 40 cents on the dollar. And they walk out and they make a fortune. And it's the same thing going over and over. But this is very important, people know. So Trump is talking about importing Argentine beef to counter high beef prices. The American consumer is not going to buy Argentina beef. Now, they're not going to buy it because, you know, they'll buy a product from another country. They'll buy a food product from another country if they think they're going to save money. But it tastes different than our beef. I happen to like it, all right? But it's not, their beef is all pasture. They don't use, the beef in Argentina is better for you than the chicken in the United States. But it tastes different. It's got a grassy taste to it. And they prepare it a little differently. And that is not going to work. And then the beef, the cattle ranches are going, you know, bonzo, because this, you know, y'all see one of some ranch in Oklahoma, that's the first time I've ever made any money. And, you know, and if you don't, the thing about beef is, you know, if you're on a budget and it's high, and I don't mean people can, there's alternatives to it, but the Argentine beef is not going to work here.
Yeah. I think you're right. Of course, the only reason he's doing it is he likes the president of Argentina because he says he's a MAGA guy. This has that $20 billion bailout to Argentina had no economic or financial justification. Argentina is not a big player at all, not even a bit player. This is just, you know, it's really amazing.
And in 1900, the Argentine economy was bigger than the French economy. Their decline is of their own making. And if we keep sending them money, nothing's going to change.
I couldn't agree more. James, let me turn to another subject. We saw betting scandals indictment this week of professional athletes, one on poker, but the other on basketball games. And I'm going to defer a lot to you because you know this issue better than I do, but I fear this is the tip of the iceberg. I think gambling opportunities are everywhere. We're not going to outlaw gambling, obviously, but you just see it everywhere. On ESPN, Sports Illustrated, at arenas, the vice chair of the University of North Carolina trustees is a gambling executive. Now, I worry about things like the prevalence of prop bets, how many incomplete passes will be tossed, thrown in the second quarter, or the over-under of how many points a mid-level college basketball player may score or not score. You know, I saw in a publication called The Dispatch this morning, they noted the prop parlay yesterday was that the New York Knicks, Jalen Brunson scores 30 or more points. Dodgers catcher Will Smith has a combined 1.5 hits, runs, and RBIs. And the Islanders-Bruins hockey contest score more than 6.5 goals. Now, there's some real professionals who follow this stuff carefully who might be able to make a decent bet on that. But you know something? That 25-year-old kid who thinks, man, I know a lot about sports. He's going to lose 9 times out of 10. And I would add to that the stupid decision by the NCAA to permit college athletes to bet on pro games. A kid falls behind, as most do on pro games, it's certainly going to be tempting to wager on his own games. As I say, you are much more knowledgeable about this than I am, but I think there are much bigger scandals ahead.
Well, my bookmaker in Baton Rouge many years ago, the great Bobby Samahar, who is unfortunately now deceased, always said, I would swim the river to book a parlay. Okay, I don't care who you are. Professional gamblers rarely bet parlays. Mm-hmm. I mean, the math on it is very difficult. Now, where you're right, of course, I picked on the Tony Kornheiser show, I'm a gambler myself, so I'm not coming at this from a holier than thou thing. But I remember laughably, the Washington Post, I think it was back in the 80s, maybe it was the 90s, decided that they would publish the pro football line, but not the college football line. I don't know what was behind that, but then they were trying to retain some veneer of ethics. Where your real problem, it's hard to throw a game. All right? I mean, if you're a starting pitcher and let's just say you're trying to throw the game, it might take you out after an inning or two. And then somebody comes in and goes lights out. If you're a basketball player, well, you got to have the ball in your hand. I mean, it's not a guaranteed event. But what is guaranteed and what is dangerous, would you bet on the number of minutes somebody's going to play?
Right.
The guy just goes out and says, you know, I twisted my ankle. And there was a documentary on the Arizona State basketball gambling scandal they had. It is pretty good. And they were throwing games. Tulane had that issue some years ago. Hot Rods? I don't know. It's one of the basketball players. I mean, they have to be vigilant. I don't, in terms of the NCAA allowing college athletes to bet on pro games, first of all, they're doing it anyway. Secondly, they get paid. It's a danger. And the people, some of the anti-gambling people, a lot of them are just scolds. But you know what? They're 20% right.
Right.
And we're not going to stop people from gambling on sports. It doesn't matter if you try to stop it. They're going to do it anyway. Now all of the big publications and sports journalism is all publishes the line. They have ESPN everybody's picking against the point spread. I do it on Tony's show. I mean, that's train has left the station. But with the Adam Silvers and the Roger Goodells and the hockey people, the baseball people, we forget how much is bet on fucking soccer because that's just... It's unbelievable. And these sports leagues better be vigilant. Really had the NBA referee some years ago.
Yeah.
Was being paid. I mean, they thought it was terrible.
James, your point about it's hard to for a team to throw a game is absolutely valid. No question. Happens, but it's really rare and it's really hard. It's not hard, however, for a kid to say, I'm going to miss five shots in the first half. I'm going to miss more than five shots in the first half. And I had a bad night, right? And I know when I first went to college in North Carolina in the early 60s, there was a huge scandal of actually centered in New York and North Carolina. And what these guys did, they found the most vulnerable kids. True, a lot of them are getting NIL, but a lot of them aren't. And that's my worry. I'm not worried about, you know, it may happen.
Anyway, but look at five shot.
Yeah.
Show Jackson, I don't think he could read. And there's a great story I heard. That he actually ran a liquor store in South Carolina, and Ty Cobb went in there. And Shula's show didn't say anything, and so Ty Cobb, and he looked at him, and he said, Joe, do you know who I am? He said, yeah, Ty, I know who you are. I just didn't think you wanted to talk to me. Okay.
Yeah.
And by the way, I mean, he was an unbelievable baseball player. If you look at his statistics, they were like, I don't know, he had 340 for the fucking World Series, but you win three games and some rich guy comes in and pays these poor illiterate kids off. You're talking about 19-year-olds in college.
That's, yeah.
You know, that Arizona State thing. You see, you go give a guy $50,000. Shit, I'll take it. It's a real problem, and the problem is most people think of the game as the point spread or the over
right.
the minutes played, how many fumbles, that kind of stuff. The over under on how many pass receptions. So you say, I take the over that Jamar Chase is going to have four receptions.
You know, somebody wrote the other day that over 2/3 of the bets are prop bets. And
yes,
and those are the ones that if I'm a crooked gambler and I want to get to some kid who not very smart and not very well off, that's where I go. But anyway, I think, you know, James Carville has given you a good education on how it works. We're going to be, I hope we don't revisit this story, but I guess we will.
You don't have to worry.
Right.
It's a problem that can only be, you know, managed downward a little bit, but it's not going to be solved because there's so fucking much money.
Yeah.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
James, our guest is one of the most informed and interesting columnists in America, especially on foreign affairs, Max Boot of the Washington Post. Max, you wrote the most compelling column the other day on the Trump campaign against Venezuela. So let me just start. What is the legal justification and rationale for blowing up those boats outside of Venezuela and those in the Pacific off of Colombia? We've already killed, what, 60 or more people. What's the both the legal and policy rationale?
That's a great question to which I don't have a great answer. I feel like this is one of many instances where the Trump White House is treating Congress and the American people with contempt. They have just launched this war in our name using the American Armed Forces but they're not really explaining what they're doing or what their legal rationale for doing it is. And in lieu of any explanation from the administration, the conclusion of many legal scholars, I would say most legal scholars, including conservatives as well as liberals, is what the administration is doing is blatantly illegal. I mean, there's a long history of the U.S. Coast Guard interdicting suspected drug vessels, but they don't just blow them up and kill people without trial. This is basically what Duterte did in the Philippines, killing people who are labeled as drug dealers in an extrajudicial way. This, by the way, is why Duterte, the former dictator of the Philippines, is now in The Hague facing trial on war crimes charges. But in the present instance, there is no authority from Congress for the armed forces to go out and blow up drug boats. There is no authorization for the use of military force. Now, the administration is trying to pretend that by labeling these folks as narco-terrorists, they can just go out and kill them. But this is a very sinister precedent. If the administration gets to go out and kill anybody they label a terrorist, you know, whoa, Nelly, bar the door. I mean, who are they going to label a terrorist next?
Well, Max, also,
there's no question that, you know, yeah.
No, correct me if I'm wrong, but even the drug rationale, which may have no legal underpinning, but even that seems to me phony. The principal killer of Americans, drug killer of Americans, has been fentanyl, which comes mainly from Mexico and China. As I understand it, Venezuela is not a big player in the drug wars against the United States.
That's absolutely true. I mean, Trump is playing fast and loose with the figures because he keeps citing all the overdose deaths from illegal narcotics in the U.S., but most of those are from fentanyl. And as you mentioned, pretty much all the fentanyl in the U.S. comes from Mexico. Pretty much none of it comes from Venezuela. And in fact, a lot of the drugs that are being shipped in the Caribbean, including some via Venezuela, a lot of those drugs are not even intended for the United States. A lot of those are heading to Europe or to Africa. And kind of the larger 50,000-foot view, remember, we've had a war on drugs for a long time, basically since 1971 when Richard Nixon declared it. We have been fighting a war on drugs for a long time. And the notion that we're going to suddenly win the war on drugs by blowing up a few speedboats is just folly. This is a business that is worth hundreds of billions of dollars. There is a huge demand in the U.S. for illegal narcotics, and we should do what we can to combat it, but we have to stay within the law, and we can't use our outrage over the actions of narco cartels to basically trash the rule of law and to put the U.S. military in a situation where they're using force unlawfully, which I fear is what's going on right now.
Also, Max, I think we all agree Maduro is a bad guy. He's corrupt. He has driven that economy into the ditch. He stole an election. But there are a lot of bad guys in the world. I mean, he's not the only one. So why do you think that Trump is focused on him and Venezuela?
Another great question without a great answer. You're right that there are a lot of bad people in the world, many of whom Trump admires and glad hands. I mean, he's super eager to renew his love affair with Kim Jong-un of North Korea, who is probably about 100 times more repressive than Maduro. And I mean, I'm not defending Maduro. As you say, he's a bad guy. He's stolen an election. He's been indicted in a U.S. court. I would hope that the people of Venezuela would overthrow him. But why is this a threat sufficient to warrant American military intervention? I have not seen any case whatsoever. And what Trump says is basically not true, where he claims, oh, Maduro is emptying the prisons and sending us all the convicts from Venezuela. That's not true. He also claims that Venezuela is a major source of illegal drugs in the U.S., which, as we've been discussing, that's not true either. I mean, you can imagine a kind of George W. Bush, you know, spread of democracy type of rationale for overthrowing Maduro, but Trump is not the guy to carry out that operation, right? I mean, he's trashing democracy at home. Why would he be promoting democracy abroad? So it really doesn't make any sense. And I actually am not 100% sure. I mean, I can understand there are people in the administration like Marco Rubio who have been focused on Maduro and overthrowing him for a long time. But why does, you know, Trump have this particular bee in his bonnet, which he's clearly had since the first administration? why is it that he's embracing certain dictators, and now in the case of Maduro, he's trying to overthrow him? It's really hard to explain it rationally or logically.
Well, Trump says, it's ordered a covert operation, which, as you wrote, really makes it overt. So if we do try to, send ground forces in, throw out Maduro, I'm sure we could do it. There's a real possibility, even a probability, though, that we'd have to have American forces there for a while, because people usually when the Yankees come in, they don't say they don't throw out the welcome banners.
Yeah, this is not going to be a cakewalk, as someone described the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. I mean, we have had a few relatively easy operations in the Latin America region, namely Grenada 1983, Panama 1989. Those were operations where the U.S. Armed Forces came in, overthrew a tyrant, and left pretty quickly and established the conditions for democracy. But Venezuela is not Grenada. It's not Panama. Those are tiny, tiny countries where you had an overwhelming American military presence. Venezuela has about the same number of people as Iraq had in 2003 when the U.S. invaded, and we all remember how well that went. This would be a massive military operation. And thankfully, I don't actually see any evidence that Trump is planning to invade Venezuela with troops. There's a huge U.S. naval armada which has been assembled in the Caribbean. But I don't see, army divisions getting mobilized, which is what it would take. I mean, it would take probably hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops to actually invade Venezuela. I'm really not sure what Trump's strategy is for trying to get rid of Maduro. As far as I can tell, it's basically to do this big show of force, to do this gunboat diplomacy, to have B-52s and B-1s flying near Venezuela, to have aircraft carrier offshore. It's possible that Trump may carry out some airstrikes within Venezuela, but none of that is going to compel regime change. Maduro can just dig in and hold on. So I'm really not sure, aside from the rationale for this operation, I'm not sure how it's supposed to work.
So go back. You did a biography of President Reagan, and there was a split in Reagan land. Nancy Reagan famously just say no to drugs. And Milton Friedman, the revered free market economist, University of Chicago, said this should be legalized. Okay? But now we have the advantage of time, and we always have it in time. Things. Who do you think had the better argument back then, Nancy Reagan or Milton Friedman?
That's a funny way to put it. Clearly the war on drugs, again, dating back to the Nixon administration, has not been a huge success because U.S. overdose deaths are higher than ever. I guess you can imagine it might be worse if we weren't doing all these interdiction efforts. But clearly, I think it's fair to say that interdiction is not enough. I think we also need a public health approach. We need a public health campaign. We need to do other things to try to reduce drug use, and simply doubling down on this militarized war on drugs, I don't see any reason to expect that's going to be successful. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean we should be legalizing cocaine or fentanyl, because those are highly addictive substances, and so we have to be very wary about how we treat them. But, just doubling down on the same approach, which has not really worked for the past 50-plus years, I don't see how that's going to be successful.
So in my career, I've worked in Mexico, I've worked in Venezuela, and I worked in Colombia. And when you bring it up, particularly in Mexico or Colombia, one of the first things you hear is, yeah, you're right, but it's the American, we're providing for it's the demand for it, and you want us to stop when our people are making money because your people, you can't control the use of drugs in your country, and they make too much money, and they've built this enormous industry, and if any way I could stop it, it would blow a hole in my economy. And literally, to make that argument. And why are you focused on the supply and you do nothing about demand? And I don't know, but freshman economics 101, one goes with the other, right?
Yeah, no, I think that's a legitimate point. I mean, I think we need to focus on both supply and demand. The way to focus on the supply is you have to work with the countries that are producing these drugs. That means we have to work with countries like Mexico, Colombia, Peru, and others. And unfortunately, President Trump is now picking fights with the leaders of many of those countries. He's in a massive spat with the leftist president of Colombia, which is now the world's number one producer of cocaine. So that's not going to be helpful. But we also need to be working, doing a lot more stuff on the demand side, you know, in the way that we reduce demand for tobacco with this major public health campaign. We need to be working to reduce demand for illegal drugs, and we need to be working on treatment options to deal with the public health consequences. And unfortunately, I don't see any kind of investment on the treatment and prevention side in the U.S. All I see is doubling down on this militarized war on drugs, which at best is going to have a very small effect at the margins, I think, as long as the demand is there, the supply will show up.
It's a huge part of the economy. I worked with President Santos, Juan Santos, who ended at the time. It didn't work. The longest ongoing conflict in the world was between the government of Colombia and the FARC. The biggest problem they had resolving that is the FARC paid people. And if you shut it down, you would have all of these, and they're not the highest quality of people in the world, okay? You would have all these people who would be unemployed. And what are they going to do with it? Because, you know, I tell people the oldest profession is prostitution, second oldest is war, third oldest, 2 seconds after war, is war profiteering. Okay? It comes with it. But I don't know. I think let's just say we could successfully stop all drug production exportation from Mexico, I'm not sure the Mexican economy wouldn't collapse. And when you'd have a bigger thing. I mean, it's just something, you know, when I see these, I'd work in these places, and then they have an entirely different perspective of anything. Not drug users. Most of the people I work for are U.S. educated. To a person, they speak English better than me, which is not very odd, all right? But they have a side of the story, and it's not that simple. And I just wanted to get a chance to, like, share that with you a little bit.
Yeah,
you know?
No, I think you're right. I mean, I think if there's one thing that we've learned over the past 50-plus years of the war on drugs, it's an enormously complicated problem. There is no obvious or easy solution. There are things you can do to reduce the problem. But, you know, Trump and Pete Hegseth and J.D. Vance, they seem to be pretending like, we're going to end drug trafficking. We're going to go out and blow up all these speedboats, and there will be no more drugs coming to the United States. I mean, that's ridiculous. I can't imagine anybody who knows anything about the problem who could possibly imagine that's the case. But that's kind of how they're posturing.
Before I let you go and turn back to Al, I mean, you're a longtime conservative. I mean, I think didn't you grow up in the Soviet Union or something?
I mean, I was born in the Soviet Union. I grew up in L.A.
Okay, but I mean,
the other L.A., Los Angeles, not Louisiana.
Very much involved in what you in American conservatism, what you thought it was, and in Reagan, it kind of was three things. He was about free trade. He was pretty loosey goosey on immigration for sure, and alliances. You know, particularly NATO, but CETO and other alliances. How do you, and I'm not doing, I'm not asking you this to like torture you or fuck with you or anything like that, but you know, I've developed a lot of friends, you know, Bill Kristol and people like that. How do you feel about your whole movement just being shattered and blown to smithereens almost? I mean, the kind of ideology and philosophy of your whole life that you dedicated to is basically non-existent in a party that you've always been accustomed to. And I promise you, I'm not doing it to torture you. But
All right, James. First, I'm going to get under my desk and roll up in a fetal ball. And after a few minutes of that, I'll try to figure out an answer to your question, which is a good one. I mean, this is larger than the conservative movement. I mean, this is like, what has happened to American politics? What has happened to the Republican Party? And yeah, it's all pretty appalling. I mean, I think you're kind of summing up why I'm not a Republican anymore and why I don't describe myself as a conservative anymore, because I don't like what those things have become. And you can argue about to what extent those trends were always present within those movements. And I think to some extent that's true. And I think that's some of the stuff I brought out, for example, in my biography of Ronald Reagan, or Sam Tannenhouse was brought out in his biography of William F. Buckley Jr. But I would say that those trends were always present, but they were not dominant. Now they've become dominant. This has become, you know, the xenophobic and nativist and racist and protectionist and isolationist, a lot of these other sentiments, which once used to be in the margins of the Republican Party, that's now the mainstream, whereas the people who used to define themselves as Republicans, those are the folks who are now the rhinos or, you know, on the margins of the movement. I think we just have to grapple with the fact that the Republican Party is not a quote-unquote conservative party anymore. It's this ethno-nationalist populist party, you know, that has more in common with the National Front in France than it does with the Tory party in the UK. And that's just, you know, this massive shift that we're witnessing before our eyes. And it's not something I ever wanted to see. But I mean, I think that's the reality of what's happened.
Well, I would editorialize just for a second. I'm going to turn it right back now. In the Democratic Party today is a theory, well, we don't agree with the identity left. But, you know, we really need these votes. So we should be we should tread very gently in how we deal with them. Part of, I think, the calculation was, I think, with a Reagan and a Buckley, and a lot of people would say, look, I don't agree with these people. They're kind of crazy, but we got to have, they're part of our coalition. We got to have their votes. And what I'm arguing to Democrats today, just like this has come and bitten Republicans, quote, on the ass, if we keep saying we got to have these votes, I mean, I think we'd be better off having them part of a governing coalition as opposed to electoral coalition, and go ahead and call yourself a democratic socialist. I mean, that's fine. And you might be able to win an election in Boston, New York. But I think these people cause more damage to the Democratic brand than votes they bring in to Democratic candidates. That's my own view. And part of that is informed by the idea that we couldn't win without these people. And ultimately, it destroyed the Republican Party that you knew. I'm sorry.
I think that's a great point. I think that's something you're right that Democrats have to grapple with. I mean, I think the Democratic Party is you know, much more centrist today than the Republican Party is. But you're right. I mean, there are these extremist elements within the Democratic Party as well, and the question is how they deal with them. And obviously, you know, the fact that Zohran Mamdani is about to be elected mayor of New York is God's gift to Donald Trump. I mean, it's going to allow Republicans to try to make Mamdani the poster boy for the entire Democratic Party in the U.S. And obviously that's unfair, but that's going to be the fallout. And that is something that I think
it's not going to
help Democrats, you know, in red states, purple states, pretty much any states outside of a few very liberal enclaves.
That is correct, Albert. Thank you so much, Max. I always like read your stuff. And in the earlier part of this century, I was in vehement disagreement with you, but I find myself coming more to your point of view. And so I appreciate you saying, Albert.
Max, let me just ask you a final question about Latin America. This administration's policy seems just absolutely crazy quilt. I mean, we're going after Venezuela. They are bad guys, as we've noted. But they are also going after Colombia and Brazil, which play an important economic, you know, security and drug policy role for the United States. And we are bailing out Argentina, which is not a player in the global financial world. I mean, what is the rationale, if there is any, behind this administration's Latin America policy? And I guess, I think you alluded to this earlier, is it really being driven by Marco Rubio?
You know, it doesn't make a lick of sense on the merits. You can try to explain it by influences like Marco Rubio or other folks. But basically, I think this is not the foreign policy of the United States. This is the personal whims and preferences of President Trump. And so, you know, he basically rewards allies and punishes critics. And so you see him, for example, imposing these massive 50% tariffs on Brazil to punish Brazil for putting his buddy, the former President Bolsonaro, on trial for carrying out Brazil's version of January 6th. And at the same time, you know, he is rewarding Argentina, which has a MAGA-friendly president, with a bailout that is something on the order of $40 billion, which hopefully we will not lose our shirts on that. But it's kind of striking that while the Trump administration is destroying U.S. foreign aid, cutting off the poorest people on the planet, a lot of whom are going to die as a result. All of a sudden, we have, you know, $40 billion just sitting around to bail out Argentina from the consequences of their own, financial, from the financial mess that they've made of their own country over many decades. It's, you know, when you lay it out like that, it's hard to add it up logically or from a policy standpoint to say why this should be the policy of the United States. But really, this is just the whims of President Trump because, you know, there's nobody in the administration or seemingly outside of it who can contradict him. And so he basically gets to do what he wants, even if it doesn't make a lot of sense.
Final question. The Canadian, the Ford ad on Reagan, which, of course, Trump went ballistic and threatened all kinds of, you know, we're going to declare war on Ottawa. The ad was basically right, wasn't it? I mean, Reagan did say those things about, and believe those things, basically about tariffs and trade.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, this is another example of how Trump is subordinating U.S. Economic and policy interests to his own personal whims, because clearly the U.S. has an overriding interest in good relations with Canada, which is one of our top trade partners and also one of our closest allies. But he's, you know, Trump has managed to alienate Canada, and he went ballistic again after the Premier of Ontario ran this very truthful commercial using Ronald Reagan's own words about how Reagan opposed tariffs, which is true. Reagan was a free trader because he lived through the Great Depression. And as he said in the very speech that was being quoted, anybody who lived through the Smoot-Hawley tariff knows tariffs are not a good thing. And Reagan was a very devoted free trader. I mean, he sometimes deviated because there was pressure in Congress for import restrictions and so forth, but he fundamentally believed that tariffs were a bad thing. Free trade is a good thing. Now Donald Trump doesn't want to hear this because he's got a big, you know, portrait of Reagan in the Oval Office. He doesn't want to hear that his policies on trade are diametrically opposed to the Gippers, but that is the truth. But, unfortunately, the Reagan Foundation claimed that this was somehow misleading. It wasn't misleading. And then Trump used this as an excuse to add more tariffs on Canada. It doesn't make any sense. But Reagan was right on tariffs and Trump is wrong.
Max, I'll tell you, the most important political person for Ronald Reagan was really Stu Spencer, starting from the very beginning.
Yeah.
I used to talk to Stu. Stu told me the last three, I think, two presidential elections, he voted Democratic for the first time in his life. He said the Gipper would have hated Donald Trump. But anyway, you have been a fabulous guest, and I can't thank you enough. And on a personal note, I hope the trip with your son to Duke went well and is going to go well.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Great to be on with you guys.
Thank you, Max. Just remember, there's never been a protectionist Democratic president. Ever.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Hey, James, we are joined by Yves Estelle, a financial wizard, but an art expert. And we want to talk to him about art and as well as gambling. James Carville is our foremost art expert on this show. So, James, you want to start?
I'll be glad to. First of all, as you said, to say what's really important about Yves Estelle is is he has married one of the most beautiful women I know, the great Kathleen Begala, who also happens to be the sister of one of our favorite people in the world, Paul Begala. So Eve, before we get started, just by way of background, how long have you been collecting art? How long have you had a passion and an interest in this kind of thing?
Oh, I would say one of the advantages of advanced age is it's been a heck of a long time. It's probably 50, 60 years. But please, my so-called collection is very modest compared to, you know, people that have these amazing collections.
And so let's talk a little bit about, I'm assuming that everybody knows what the Louvre is and knows its significance. It is, by the way, the single most visited museum in the world, which is interesting. What kind of pieces did these people steal? I mean, what was their historical significance? So why is it a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal because it happened. And it was in the crown jewels room. And they took four main objects that had belonged basically to Napoleon's second wife, to the child of his first wife, and some from Napoleon III's wife. So the total value is estimated at, you know, 100 plus million. And meaningfully, the rest of the crown jewels have now been moved to the Bank of France, which is sort of the Fort Knox of France. So they're not taking any chances with the rest for this minute.
So how does, because we know there's going to be movies after this, do you think that they had arranged a way to fence these, to get rid of them prior to stealing them? It looks like it's not just these people that were arrested. There had to be other collaborators, right?
Well, yeah, we don't know that much about the ones being arrested. Parenthetically, on our way into Paris this morning, we went by where they were held, but we didn't have a chance to see them to report to you. so basically, we don't know that much about them. But what makes it such a big deal, apart from the historical significance, is, you know, the Louvre is the biggest fish you can go and try to pick up or get. And jewel thieves in jail always boast with each other about which was the biggest robbery that they did, sort of like golfers in the locker room about their score. And doing the Louvre is the Super Bowl of jewelry heists.
So help us as Americans, because when somebody's arrested, the FBI can't wait to put their picture up and say they made this arrest. Apparently, it's different in France because we know they're arrested, but we don't know anything about them. We don't know their names, do we?
Well, the issue is they haven't been charged. They've been put on suspicion of whatever it is that they did, but until they're charged, the information's supposed to remain confidential. And in fact, the French prosecutor involved apologized to the public for releasing for a leak of some of the information about one of them, which is both against the legal practice, but also probably hinders trying to catch the others by giving them more warning.
So immigration is a huge issue in French politics. You know, culture, what it means to be French. And we don't know who these people are, but let's assume they're not French in the sense of they're kind of born in France or whatever, but they come from immigrant, or they were immigrants or they're illegally. Do you think this could have repercussions going forward in French politics and sort of elevate some of these more right-wing nationalist anti-immigrant parties?
I wouldn't exclude it. The only thing that I know in that regard that's been said is that one of the two arrested is Algerian. There's a huge community in France, and the older community came to work in the car factories and integrated and became very good middle-class citizens. There's been more issues with their children, some of which have been radicalized. But I don't think that's the main thrust of what's going on with the Louvre jewelry. I think the two main things are, one, that everybody loves a big jewelry robbery. Okay. You know, we've had Ocean's 11. The French have had the equivalent there. The most famous French movie is a heist movie called Rififi from the 1930s, which has a 30-minute silent heist. Not a word, not a sound. And it's the most famous. So everybody loves jewel thieves. And these guys were clearly had inside information, because they clearly knew that the windows were breakable into, and the same for the cases. They used power tools. And that was a room without a security camera. The protocol in the Louvre is that it's full of tourists, so they did it when it was full of tourists. And whoever was guiding the tourists, their protocol was evacuate. And the museum guards, like most museum guards, don't carry guns. Now, the only thing was timing. Police come in 10 minutes to these things, so they did it in 7.
James, let me interrupt to ask one question. I think it's to me so obvious that there was an inside job. There was an inside accomplice. It had to be. 7 or 8 minutes is just extraordinary. Everything about it worked. That shouldn't be that hard to find out who it was, Eves. I mean, you know, there were only certain people that knew everything. And I would imagine, I don't know what we know, but isn't that a big part of the investigation now?
I presume so, since the rest of the investigation's under wraps. There will be in the French Senate, one of the leaders yesterday opened, you know, typical political, but with a point, saying, Louvre is such a great institution, how come we don't have equally great security?
It speaks pretty badly for the Louvre, doesn't it?
It does, except, you know, the Louvre is 60 acres big. So if you think of the number of windows and their operating budget, it's only about $300 million a year. And if they insured everything that's of value, it would probably double their operating budget. So that's why they self-insure.
Yeah, but how many windows have $100 million? Other than the Mona Lisa, how many have $100 million worth of jewels within a couple yards of when you break in?
Well, not that many, but I can tell you that the Louvre opened an annex to halfway to Belgium in a town called Lens, or Lens in English. And they were going to lend the Mona Lisa to the Lens Museum in order to show how seriously that museum should be taken. And they found out that the insurance alone to move it for 2 weeks or whatever it was to a month, the Lens, was over $35 million. So that project died. The point is, they have an extraordinary trove of very valuable objects. I mean, think of the Greek craters and the Greek statues and the Islamic, and then all the paintings. So it's a very tough situation. But as you said, they'll probably be able to. I don't think it was an inside job, and I think it was inside information that was fed to these people.
Right.
And you know, it was very clever because they used this forklift truck. And nobody cared or noticed because, as you know, French buildings are mostly older that people live in. They have narrow stairways. So it's a common sight to see this specific kind of truck and these specific kind of workers lifting things up and in.
Yeah. I'm going to turn it back to our art expert, James Pierre Carville.
So, Eva, I don't want to let you go, but my question is, you were born in Paris, is that correct?
Yes.
Tell us the circumstances. Why did you leave Paris and why did you end up in Princeton and New York City? What's the backstory about how he left beautiful Paris and ended up in the United States? Much to our glee and joy.
Well, thanks, James, but it wasn't voluntary. I was 4 years old in 1940, and as the Germans had broken through the Maginot Line, were heading to Paris. My father, who was in the U.S. By good happenstance, called my mother and said, get the kids out. And there's a long and very lucky story of how she got us through the Spanish border into Portugal, and other friends helped get us the visas into the States. So
you're our favorite guest.
I'm grateful every day.
You're one of our favorite guests for one reason. You're older than both of us, which doesn't happen very often.
This is a new record. Well, Eve, thank you so much. It's a fascinating story, and we really, really do appreciate your time.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
All right, now for the outrage of the week, and I'm about to do anything but an outrage, James. Wow, did we need these baseball playoffs and the World Series? What games? What superstars? We've seen it all. Walk-off home runs, 19 pitchers in an 18-inning game, fabulous defensive plays, future Hall of Famers Vladimir Guerrero, my favorite player of all times, Max Scherzer, Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman, and, of course, Shohei Ohtani. You know, when the series goes back to Toronto, however it turns out, our children and our grandchildren will talk about baseball in October of 2025 and the greatest player of all times, Shohei Ohtani. Throughout the playoffs, he's been a spectacular hitter and pitcher, even in his one defeat pitching Tuesday night. The great Babe Ruth, people know, was a top pitcher and a record-setting hitter. He sure was. But only for a few seasons did he try to do both. And in his peak years with the Yankees in the 1920s, he stopped pitching because he said doing it both ways was too arduous. I don't know how to say arduous in Japanese. Neither does Ohtani. In our Sunday Zoom call, James, you'll recall we tried to think of any single performance like Ohtani's 3 home runs and 6 shutout innings in the National League Championship. Roger Altman suggested the only conceivable competition might be the iconic horse Secretariat's stunningly dominant victory in the Belmont 52 years ago, a record that still stands today. But I certainly think it's safe to say that I'm sorry, Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, Serena Williams, you all were unbelievable, but the greatest athlete on 2 feet, my vote goes to our great import from Japan, who's given us some marvelous moments this October.
Well, I agree. I just said one little thing is, and I have every confidence he will. If he produces at this level for another 5 years, he is going to be unquestionably the greatest athlete in a specific sport that ever lived. I mean, you might say Jim Thorpe had more range, he could do more sports, or Jim Brown. But Jim Brown, right, I think Ohtani, you can say, I never thought I'd say this to anybody, he's a better baseball player than Jim Brown was a football player.
Well, Jim Brown didn't play defensive.
Right.
You know,
if you look at all the great basketball players, I mean, what this guy is just as a baseball player. It's staggering, man. And, you know, we used to sit around and talk about the glory days and, the Yankees and the Dodgers and the great teams and shit. I wish these things would start. I know they've been through this 1,000 times. The goddamn games start too late. I fall asleep at my computer. But
that's true.
I'm 100% endorse it. And by the way, if you look at what people don't understand, if you include the Canadian numbers, which is 40 million people, Toronto might have the largest TV market, more than the Yankees or the Mets or the Dodgers. Mm-hmm. If you stop and you think about it, they have a whole country of 40 million people. And don't even think, I mean, baseball is far and away the biggest sport in Japan. And they got the Dodgers, give them credit. They're not stupid. Can you imagine what their TV rights are in Japan? It's funny because everybody is always writing the end of baseball. And you know what? It ain't going to end.
Boy, I'll tell you something. It sure as heck got a tremendous boost in the month of October. And however the series ends in Toronto, God, it's been a great run. James, like you, I'm afraid I can't stay up as late. I wish I were 20 years younger. But I go and I do watch the next day. And I'll tell you something else I did. James, I went after Roger's comment about Secretariat. I went and I looked at that Belmont race again. Oh my God, it gets even more awesome. And in the final stretch run, the announcer said, "This is a machine out there running." Yeah, it's amazing. And he got stronger as the race went on. I mean, he was up by 10 lengths and then by 15 lengths and by 31. It was just amazing. But the greatest athlete I've seen on two legs, I still think is Ohtani, but
yeah.
Anyway,
but it sure looked. I'm not going to. It sure looks like that. It's on track that way.
I mean, yeah,
a few more seasons. I don't have any doubt that he's going to get them. I alluded to it earlier. Mala Harris has a book out. All right, she has a right to do that. Most people who lose a presidential race have a book out, and the reviews will have to speak for themselves. But it's like she's thinking about running in 2028 and we need this and that. If all of the people in the world, and I'll just say this very blunt, I do not feel sorry for her. You were the DA of San Francisco. You were the Attorney General of California. You were a United States Senator from California. You were Vice President of the United States. You were handed the uncontested nomination to your party, and I've met her husband. He's this utterly lovely, successful man. All right, you're well off. So I don't feel sorry for you. There's no pity here, and I can't stop you from running again. But I can promise you, you're not going to get the nomination. And then I'm treated to Karine Jean-Pierre, who was Biden.
Oh, my God. Go ahead.
And so she goes on with this guy, Ozzie Kotner, who I don't think I know, but it seems to me like it's a, you know.
He does some of the great Q&As in American journalism.
Right. And she goes on, promoting a book. Okay, I've done books, you go. Well, they ask you about the book. Okay? That's what your question gonna be about. If she started attacking him, then she shouldn't answer that because she's a black lesbian female. Lady, please, do your book tour and then shut the fuck up. Please.
James, she said that it was outrageous that some people thought that the nomination shouldn't be handed to Kamala Harris. And then she said, she goes on and she really says, of course I knew she couldn't win. Well, what the hell is the point of a nomination if you can't win? Okay. She has every right to publish the book, but I have every right, James, not to read it.
I agree. And one's opinion is not determinative by their gender, their race, their sexual identity, or anything else. You know, some people wrong, some people right. But God damn, I wonder if these people have any self-awareness. I mean, does somebody say that she have a publisher, that her wife, or well, I don't know, whatever? Did somebody say, man, you, what you're saying makes utterly no sense at all?
No. Now, for our favorite segment, the listener questions, they are so good. Bree in Belleville, Illinois, James, says, when Trump's current momentum will it shift someday to Vance or someone like Stephen Miller when he's gone?
You know, and I don't know what order show is, so if it's in a different order. You know, what I keep hearing is the people like, that know these issues, particularly national security and foreign policy, is just are more afraid of Vance than they are Trump. Because Trump don't, he just does whatever he wants. He's a pretty stupid Vance is anything but, and they think he's a real threat. Let's just say, I don't wish this on anybody, but Trump just was not president in a week and Vance was there. Apparently, I mean, Vance will be able to say, he was picked by Donald Trump, which I think would give him a huge leg up, unless Trump, which you don't know, he would not know what he would say, or if he would say somebody else, and that would have a huge effect. But and it's there is no Republican Party. I can't emphasize that enough. We had talk about Ronald Reagan. There's Donald Trump and Ronald Reagan. It couldn't be any more unlike people.
Totally. You know, James, I got a prediction, which is it's 3 years away, so it's always safe to make because hopefully no one will remember. I think Trump will give J.D. Vance his blessing, and I think his ask or his condition will be he picks Donald Jr. as his running mate. And I don't think that's out of the, you know, no one could be, well, there are people who are less qualified, but he's on top of the list. Trump will not want that Trump name to go away. His ego is.
Yeah, he'll tell me anything. And the one thing you know about J.D. Vance, he ain't gonna say no.
Right. Yeah. We've seen that.
But people, I'm surprised at the number of people that I talk to that are knowledgeable, and particularly in areas that I'm not that knowledgeable in, that say that Vance scares them more than Trump.
Yeah. You know, that leads us to John's from Santa Monica, the great Santa Monica. And he says, what do you know about the so-called plan that Steve Bannon has for Trump to run for president as a third term in 2028? John, let me just say this. It is not going to happen. There is no way, Jose. It just is not. We waste a lot of time, a lot of chop down too many trees, whatever they do for desktops and laptops. It's not going to happen. Bannon talks about, you know, Vance getting the nomination. Trump is, it's just all conjecture from people who like to have fun. So, Donald Trump at most has 3 more years. The goddamn, that's a frightening thought.
I'll get that question sometimes and I get almost irritated by it. You understand. That if Trump couldn't win, I wish they'd let him run. Okay, I don't think he's anywhere close going to be sufficiently healthy in another over 3 years to do anything. But he would lose so bad. And I don't look at the Supreme Court. The language of the 22nd Amendment couldn't be any clearer. I don't think they give a shit. The language of the 14th Amendment couldn't be any clearer.
Right, right.
You think that they care if this is what would if this would protect corporate power? John Roberts don't give a shit. Would it be Clarence Thomas give him an RV to go to Nebraska football game or Leo give him a fishing trip or whatever he wants? But they're not going to do that because they know that Trump would get slaughtered. The only way he won was that we almost forced people to vote for him. And annoyed would he been elected in 2024. If he ran today, there's no way he would win an election. No.
I absolutely. James, John in Chicago says, do you think it'll come down to Trump asking the military to protect him?
To protect him from, John, I think what you're saying is from arrest?
You're right. The question is not clear, but I think it's but take off because the military and Trump is a fascinating relationship. I think maybe the better question is, will the military stand up to him at some point?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, first of all, those guys are so trained to follow civilian authority,
right?
And it would have to be a pretty extraordinary reach of presidential power. Hey, this guy, he goes on look, he's pretty popular in the rank and file. All he talks about is the magnetic launch as opposed to the steam launch or the elevators on an aircraft carrier. I mean, at least as if the Navy didn't test this. I mean, one thing I know about the military, maybe the Navy as much as anything, they test things 100,000 times before they're going to change a launch system on an aircraft carrier or an elevator. If you stop and you think about it, an elevator is a real, 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 real critical part of an aircraft carrier, because if you can't get the aircraft on the deck, it's not going to do you any good. But it'd have to be something pretty extraordinary. Now, what they're doing is they're leaving, they're retiring. I don't know what the effect of this is on training, particularly I don't think it's going to affect enlisted training very much, but I don't know if service academies, you know, maybe in a couple of years we need to see if there's been a real effect, because a lot of these people are leaving. They don't want to be part of this.
Right.
That's crazy.
Yeah. Roger in Los Angeles says, why didn't the Democrats do anything to prepare for this unbelievable situation where one man could break an entire country? Roger, I think you cast your net too far. I think in 2016, Hillary Clinton, who should have been the Democratic nominee, just ran a really bad campaign. She should have beaten Donald Trump. But the villain this last time was very simple. It's Joe Biden. Joe Biden said he would serve as a bridge. He was aging, clearly. I saw the other day that Hunter was furious at Obama for helping him off the stage at that L.A. event in 2024. For God's sakes, he needed to be helped off the stage. He was a doddering old man. And if Joe Biden, I'll go to my deathbed thinking if Joe Biden hadn't run, there would have been a competitive primary. Some Democrat would have prevailed and beaten Trump. But I think the Democrats as a party have a lot of problems, to be sure. But I think the primary responsibility for Trump today rests with Joe Biden.
That's like saying I'm going to go to my death believing in gravity.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll talk about it. In terms of Hunter Biden, look, he did some really stupid goddamn things. Said $50,000 a month from a Ukrainian energy company. I mean, if he cared so much about his father, it looks like he wouldn't have done so much shit to embarrass him.
Absolutely.
You know, getting him on the phone and whatever. And I don't criticize President Biden for pardoning his own son. I think he was a target of malicious prosecution, but I think he was guilty of some shit, okay?
Yeah.
He wasn't like Chelsea Clinton or
right.
Obama
right.
Chelsea, or anything like that. He was not. Right. He traded on his family name, but it would look like after you've gone through all of that, you would do the simple thing and just shut the fuck
right.
up.
Speaking of that, James, that leads us to the next question from Michael in Maquon, Illinois, who says, is it time for Kamala Harris to step off the stage? Why does she seem like she's going for a comeback?
Well, okay. Let me be very clear here. No one that had anything to do with 2024, no Democrat wants to hear from you. Not we all voted for you, okay? Not Hunter Biden, not Harris, not Tim Walz, not the consultants, not anything. The 2024 has left such a lingering bad taste in Democrats. We just get out of the way. That's what I believe.
All right, next, John in Gurnee, Illinois asks, would it do any good for members of the Supreme Court bar to start resigning in protest of the court's horrible decision? Wouldn't do much good. It's not going to happen. These are people who have clients who argue before the court. I do think, however, that critics should not let up. I think that this Republican Supreme Court, they're going to probably undo the final vestiges of the Voting Rights Act. They have let Trump get away with just horrible things, going back to their first decision, which encouraged a lot of this in June of 2024. So I don't think the bar members resigning would help, but I think the criticism ought to be direct. It ought to be, you know, high level. But what this court's doing is, you know, somebody wrote the other day, I think it was Ron Brownstein, it goes back to what the right-wing court was doing, you know, at the turn of the last century. And they were trying to undo all the progressive measures.
Well, I look, these guys arrogant. They are there at the service of corporate power and the Republican Party. I would remind our viewers that nowhere is it written that they it's a statute that says you have to have 9. It's not a constitutional provision. I don't think the Democrats need to run on that, but if they win, just jack up the number to 13. Why not?
Mitch McConnell let it be at 8 for the entire year of 2016.
Right. I mean, if this is what they're going to do, then why are we stuck with this shit? And if they say it can't go to 13, then send a goddamn army in and take them out, of which the commander in chief could do. But it's a very serious, very, very serious problem.
If we didn't get to your question this week, please send them in next week. It's so hard to choose because there's so many good ones. And we really, really appreciate it. You make us think. And as I say, it may be my favorite segment, but keep those questions coming. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you'd send out the links to our recent sponsors in our past episode show notes. Now, we thank you for supporting them because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now, remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we'll be back next week with another program as we continue our War Room planning.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Eastern and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.